Get used to this voice.
Hey, y'all. I'm Tommy Tomlinson.
Tommy Tomlinson is the host of a new podcast on WFAE. It's called Southbound. Here's Tommy from the podcast's opening.
So, this is the start of a new thing. A podcast about the South, told through conversations with people who grew up here, live here, and have spent time thinking about how this place shapes who they are and what they do.
I love Tommy's voice. There's power in what he says and how he says it. You're going to get to know a lot of interesting people through Tommy's voice on Southbound, but let's get to know Tommy. He grew up in coastal Georgia on St. Simon's Island with the smells of shrimp and grease at home. His mom worked a shrimp packing line, and his dad ran maintenance at that same seafood processing plant. He says it was a diverse upbringing, but he didn't realize the significance of that until later on.
Where I grew up, it was just the way life was, and you played with kids from different races. You got in fights with them. You hung out with them and made friends with them. Even though it was clear, especially as I got older, that we had different life experiences and that people older than us thought of those things differently, it wasn't as big a deal in my sort of youth group.
Tommy went to the University of Georgia, not quite sure what to do. The law had some appeal, but he didn't want to wear a suit. Then he started writing for the college paper his junior year. A journalism career was born. He eventually made his way to the Charlotte Observer as a reporter, and then there was an opening for a local columnist.
And that was a job I'd always wanted to do. And there was a long process where they sort of weeded out who they wanted. They interviewed a bunch of people. I think there was some indecision there about who to hire and that sort of thing. And from the time I first applied for it, a year and a half went by before they actually came to me and asked me to do the job.
Wow.
And so that was in 1997. And so I wrote my first column as a local columnist there in 97.
And what was your first column?
It was just an introductory, like, hey, this is who I am, and
right,
and that sort of thing. And then I wrote, the next one was about, this was in the middle of a lot of discussions about homosexuality in the community, and the AIDS crisis was still sort of a big deal. And there had been a big debate over depictions of homosexuality in the arts here.
Yes.
That was what people in Charlotte kind of knew as the Angels in America debate. And one of the, I believe it was county commissioners, had said something about, you know, he kind of wished homosexuals would be sent off the ends of the earth or something. I may not be quoting that just right, but it was that sort of sentiment. And there was another commissioner who had had a gay son who had died of AIDS. And so I did a column on that commissioner and how he listened to those remarks and how that felt to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of my first sort of actual column. And that, you know, got a lot of response, positive and negative. And I learned pretty quickly that being a columnist was sort of a touchstone for people in the community to sort of think about their feelings and react to their feelings. And I was sort of the conduit through which a lot of people figured out how they thought about things.
I wanted to ask you about that. What did being a columnist give you or provide? What opportunities did it provide you that you might not have had as a straight reporter?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you get to sort of speak directly to your audience in a way that a reporter doesn't. And I can just say, this is how I feel, or this is how I think about this. And, you know, that objectivity that you have to have as a straight news reporter, you need the opposite as a columnist. You need to say, this is what I think. You need to be able to fairly depict how other people feel, and you need to fairly depict what they tell you, and if you're writing about somebody else. But in the end, it's your voice and it's your column and it's what you think. And that also allows you to make a more direct personal connection with readers. You know, if there's something going on in your life that is reflected in whatever's going on in the news, if there's something that, you know, you're going through that you just want to write about and talk about and have readers react to, you could do that in a way that is sort of taboo if you're a news reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And so that immediacy of that connection and that directness, like just like I'm talking to you now, is a thing that you really don't have in straight sort of news and feature journalism. And so that direct connection with readers, you know, sometimes you get a lot of blowback from that. but that you also get a lot of just an intimate connection with people that is hard to have in other types of writing.
When I arrived, I think you were in Boston for your Nieman Fellowship. I've been here 9 years. So I came familiar with you after you returned.
Right.
And I never got the sense that you were – I mean, I loved your writing, but you weren't partisan. And there were a lot of columnists that were – they just like to see their own opinions in print. I never got that feeling from you that you like to – try to understand people and where they're coming from, and that was more of the goal. You might give your opinion on some things, or we can see where you're coming from, but you're still trying to understand where someone else is coming from.
I hope so. I mean, I always think about empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you don't agree with somebody else, you try to step into their shoes for a little bit, see what they're thinking, and even if you end up feeling a different way, you try to kind of see where they're coming from. And so, you know, certainly in some of my columns, I have pretty strong opinions. Mm-hmm. But I always tried to at least understand what people who disagree with me were thinking and not think of them as, you know, just cardboard cutouts to be knocked over, but to think about them as human beings. Because that's the way it works. I mean, you talk to somebody who you disagree with on something, if you talk to them for long enough, they're not just two-dimensional anymore. They're, you know, I've always thought about feature reporting or interviewing or something, that if you talk to somebody long enough, eventually they have to become themselves, and that they don't put up that front that they think they might be trying to put up to either please you or antagonize you or whatever. After a while, people sort of become who they are. And that's where I like to get to in interviews, is when people become sort of who they are, and that's when they're always more interesting, and people are always more than their opinions, you know. And so I try to not just reduce somebody to one line of what they've said somewhere, or one opinion that I might disagree with, or whatever. I try to think about it in a more, I guess, kind of three-dimensional way.
It's magical, is it, when you forget that you're obviously, you know, you're doing an interview, but in a way you forget you're doing an interview.
Sure. I mean, you want it to become just a conversation between two people. And that's sort of aimed maybe in a direction, you know, like you want to talk about this subject or these subjects. But ideally what it gets to is just two people talking and whatever it comes up. I mean, I've found in interviews that often the best parts of the interview are the stuff I didn't expect to talk about when we started.
Do you go into an interview with a plan, or do you write out all your questions? Do you just write a few? What's your style?
I used to write out a lot of questions, and then I realized that when people saw that, it felt like you were being sort of grilled by the police or something. You know, that list of questions, if you're the person being interviewed, can look very intimidating. So what I learned to do is to sort of, and what I've learned to do, and this is over a long period of time, mm-hmm. is reduce it to two or three topics that I want to make sure that we discuss. And I'll write those down, and then I'll fold that up and put it in my pocket. And then I'll just start a conversation with somebody. At the end of the conversation, I'll look at that piece of paper, and if there's one or two of those topics we haven't gotten to, I'll go back and try to cover that stuff. Now, there may be certain interviews where there's one or two questions you have to ask, like, you know, did you kill your wife or whatever? If that's the point of the interview, you got to ask that at some mm-hmm. point. But most of the time, the stuff I like to do is conversational in nature, and they're getting toward, you know, you're sort of generally moving toward something. And so I trust myself that we'll eventually get there.
So Southbound, you've done a few interviews now. Are you doing the same thing with this podcast?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. You know, as I'm researching each person and thinking about what we'd like to talk about, you know, I have, I haven't done this radio or podcast type stuff to a great extent, and so I'm learning how to ask questions a little differently. Maybe not how to talk quite so much as I'm. You know, I'm just learning how this works. But the idea of how to do it is the same, in that I'm thinking about what I want to talk to this person about. I'm reducing that to a few topics that are kind of in my head as we start. And then I just start a conversation, and I see where it goes. And I'm kind of glancing at my notes every once in a while, but not that often. And the conversation goes where it goes. And I think so far they've gone into some pretty interesting places.
I know you love the people you've interviewed so far. I know you have a list of some dream interviews. Who are some people you'd like to try to nail down someday? Not that we will.
They're on my list. I think about one of the quintessential Southern lives for me is Dolly Parton, somebody who grew up just dirt poor and terrible conditions, created something magical out of that background, and has had just this fascinating life. And now, in the latter stages of her career, is not only still performing and still doing great stuff, but is sort of exemplifying that life she has in the South. She's gone back and has spent millions of dollars in her home area in East Tennessee to sort of help people out. When the Gatlinburg fires happened last year, she went in and basically gave everybody who had been burned out some money to sort of get their lives back together. She's just had a fascinating life. Michael Jordan is certainly somebody that I would love to talk to, and I don't think I've heard much of a conversation about him as a Southerner, as somebody who grew up in Wilmington and had to face whatever racial issues he had to face, but also being, a star basketball player, and has decided to come back and not just live in the South, but work here as owning the Charlotte Hornets, and sort of what he sees as somebody who really made it big, and has come back. People like John Lewis, who has sort of led this exemplary Southern life as a civil rights activist and is still fighting hard.
From your home state?
From my home state of Georgia, yeah. Probably one of the most influential people in the history of the South, and still, I think, a little underrated in what he did and what he still does.
Why is that?
Well, I think because for much of his career, he was sort of in the background to people like Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson. John Lewis is an incredible speaker, incredible activist, but Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson were sort of at a different level in the public realm. But John Lewis has been steady on for 50 or 60 years now, and he was on the front lines. He got beaten. He got bloodied, and he has survived it all and has thrived and come out the other side. And I think just the scope of what he has seen and participated in and been a part of over the last, 60 years as a Southerner is pretty astonishing to me. So those are just a few, but there's a big, long list of people. And I encourage people who are listening to this or whatever to suggest other folks, because I want to keep adding to that list.
When we first started talking about doing this podcast, you were concerned about your voice. And I'm sure people listening to you are curious about your voice, and I know you've talked about it some, but what happened with your voice?
Yeah, so the short answer is that in 1993, when I was 29, I was diagnosed with throat cancer. There are lots of reasons people get throat cancer. I was not one of the people who had any of the, I didn't smoke. I was not an alcoholic. A lot of the reasons that people get this type of cancer, I didn't fall into those categories. My doctor told me at the time that with every disease, there's 5% of the people that the diagnosis is other, and I was other. And so I ended up having surgery that removed about 40% of my voice box. I didn't know at the time if I was ever going to be able to speak again, which was a really terrifying thing to have made a life as a reporter and to be wondering if you'd be able to talk. But obviously, I was able to talk. I just ended up with this raspy voice that some people find appealing. Some people find a couple of my friends have called me obscene phone caller in training. some people find it sort of off-putting. At least twice a week, ever since in the last 20, however many years it's been, somebody will ask me if I have a cold or if I'm okay. But this is my voice, and I've had to learn to work with it and live with it. And in some ways, it has turned out to be an advantage. I can't yell across the room anymore. So I'm not the type of person who's going to be in a locker room, shouting out questions or at a press conference, hollering at the governor or whatever it is. I have to find other ways to do my job. And what I've found is that where I am better is in more intimate settings, when I'm close up with somebody, or I'm, and just the fact of being close to somebody, you know, in a physical space or just in a quieter setting, brings a different vibe to the interview and makes people think in a different way. And I feel like in a much more enriching and powerful way for the kinds of stories I like to do. And so just the fact that people have to pay attention to listen to me, and that they have to kind of get in close sometimes, I think has turned out to be advantageous in the type of stories that I like to do. Now, would I rather have my old voice back? Yeah. But I've found ways to work with what I got.
What were you like before you lost part of your voice?
It's funny. I have much more of a Southern accent. There's one tape of me with my old voice. Just before all this happened, I made a videotape for my mom for Christmas one year. And we still got it. And you can hear my old voice on it. And I sounded much more country than I do now. Although not nearly as Southern as a lot of my relatives, like especially the older folks in my family. I think TV sort of leveled out a lot of Southern accents when you started hearing that sort of flat Midwestern accent on television. That sort of dampened a lot of Southern accents, I think. So people in my family sound a lot more Southern than even I did back then. But I sounded much more Southern than I do now.
Were you more brash or loud, or were you one of those reporters who would yell things out?
I probably so. I mean, I think even then I gravitated to quieter stuff. But certainly when I had that, you know, note in my range, I probably used it. I didn't feel as uncomfortable in those settings as I do now. I probably did shout across rooms more often, and I was maybe made me a little more obnoxious. I don't know. I have to ask people I was around back then to see. But
were you married before or before your?
I was married after.
Okay.
but I have friends who've been around since the beginning, basically, and so that would be a good question for them. But yeah, I mean, it has changed the way I have to approach interactions with people. Hmm. And that, I think that has made a difference in one way or the other.
Are you a better listener because of it?
I think so. Because I now realize that people have to pay attention to listen to me. And I think because, you know, as part of eliminating part of my voice box, it also made my windpipe a little smaller. And so it takes me a little more effort to get a full breath than it used to. And so I can't talk in one unbroken string, you know, like stream of consciousness for 2 or 3 minutes, or I just run out of breath. And so I talk in shorter bursts, I think, than I used to. And that's been helpful too, in that I probably shut up more often than I used to. And that makes me a better listener as well.
How did you find out that you had throat cancer? Was it by accident? Were you in pain?
I thought I had laryngitis. My voice started going out, and I felt no pain. And went to a doctor who sent me to a ear, nose, and throat doctor, who looked at my throat and saw a polyp, and he said, "This is probably benign. We'll take it out. It's outpatient surgery." And he went in and took it out, and they did the biopsy, and it wasn't benign. And so they had to do – I had a choice at the time between surgery and radiation. Surgery, the upside was they would get all the cancer. And the downside was I would lose my voice substantially and maybe permanently. The radiation, the upside was I'd probably get to keep my voice. The downside was they weren't sure they could get all the cancer that way. And after sort of agonizing – both ways, I decided no matter how my voice came out, I wanted to get rid of the cancer. And so that's the option I took.
You still get checkups to make sure it hasn't
returned? I don't. 5 years out, and this type of cancer is considered to be, you're done. And so I got pretty regular checkups for 5 years. And now if something else happens, it'll be for another reason. It won't be because of that.
Another, I know, challenge you've talked about, your subject of a book you're writing is your weight.
Yeah.
Did you grow up overweight? Where'd you grow up? What's your story here?
Well, it's a long story, which is why I wrote a book about it. Mm-hmm. But I'll try to sum it up pretty quickly. Yeah, I was a fat kid for as long as I can remember. I've always been overweight. And from the time I was little, I sort of craved, you know, snacks that were bad for me. I was the kind of kid who always snuck in the fridge in the middle of the night. I grew up in a big Southern family where, you know, fried chicken and pork chops and, you know, if you had beans, you threw a chunk of ham in there and pecan pie and all that delicious stuff was just part of what we ate all the time. And so that sort of, you know, and I also grew up in a very blue collar family where they would eat all that stuff and then go work it off every day. By the time I came around, I was more of a bookish kid, mm-hmm. and ended up in white collar jobs. And so I didn't go burn off those calories in the cotton fields like some of my ancestors did. And so that weight that I added in stayed on. And so it's been a thing that I've dealt with my whole life and tried to overcome. I've done all the Weight Watchers and, you know, lean cuisines and crash diets and all that sort of thing. And only in the last couple of years have I sort of adopted sort of a slow and steady method of trying to lose a little bit of weight at a time. And I have managed to, over the last couple of years, lose a fair amount of weight. I'm still a big overweight guy, you know, the clinical definition of obese, but I feel like I'm sort of heading in the right direction. And that's part of what the book is about. You know, part of it is just all the things that I've dealt with over these years trying to lose weight and get in better shape. And part of it is trying to find my way to a healthier and hopefully longer life.
Are you happier trying to on this path, or is it more challenging? Is it what's?
I used to just really get frustrated and then do what so many other people do, which is sort of do some kind of crash diet or just say, I'm going to starve myself for a while. I'm just going to eat celery and carrots or something, you know, and that it just never works. I mean, it works the way I say it in the book is every diet works in the short term. Almost no sort of crash diet works in the long term because it has to be sustainable. And people can't sustain any sort of rigorous, really hardcore diet over the long term. The only way to do it, I've come to believe, is through just tapering off and being really slow and steady and being willing to live with small gains. And I'm by gains in this sense, mm-hmm. I mean losses, but
right.
but with small victories and being patient.
How much weight have you lost?
That I'm saving for the book.
Okay. I thought you were going to say that, but I had to ask.
But that's okay. It's a fair question. I will say that it's been the most that I've ever lost by a pretty substantial margin. And I hope to keep heading in that direction.
Well, the podcast, what are your goals for the podcast for Southbound?
I've lived in the South my whole life. The only year I didn't live in the South is 1 year that I spent in Boston. And in fact, having grown up in Georgia, lived in the Carolinas and in Florida, Charlotte is actually the furthest north I've ever lived, except for that 1 year up in Massachusetts. So I am born, raised, steeped, love, hate, admire, am furious at all the emotions you can think of about the South. You know, this is a place of great beauty, of great agony, of great comforts and great contradictions. But I do think there's a place where maybe some of us who grew up here, born and raised here, can sort of talk some of this stuff out. And that was the idea I had on this podcast, was just to have a series of conversations with notable Southerners of all types to talk about the particulars of their lives, whatever they were and wherever they went. But at some point to sort of pull all these conversations back to what their thoughts and their emotions about living and being raised in the South, you know, how they have dealt with those things. Because everybody sees it a little differently. And everybody has a different story. And so I want to approach those stories from all kinds of different angles. And whether it's, you know, athletes like Michael Jordan or musicians like Dolly Parton or activists like John Lewis or all these other people that I have on this list or people that I'm going to talk to or have already talked to, that's what I want the conversations to all come around to, is how do we process this place that we live in and have chosen to live in? Some people went away and came back. Some have been born and raised here and never left. I want to explore why we're here and how we process what the South is like back then and now and how we deal with it. And so that's what I hope in these conversations accumulate into, is sort of a library of thoughts and feelings about how we're thinking about the South now and in the future.
Tommy Tomlinson, host of WFAE's Southbound podcast. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.